copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
The extraordinary design of the bombardier beetle, it really is a remarkable creature, and I want to share with you why I think it is remarkable. I've worked as a professor of thermodynamics for many years at the University of Leeds. I'm an emeritus professor, no longer working for money, basically, but they still have me on the staff doing nothing. Not getting paid anything for doing something. I think that's a better description. So another title I've sometimes used is insect inspiration. But I need to address, as I've put in the outline, what is biomimetics? There are still people joining us. We're almost at 30 now, which is rather encouraging. So I'll just slow up slightly because that was just the title slide if you've just joined us. But we need to address the question, biomimetics, what is it? Well, it means learning design from creation to inspire innovative engineering. That means engineering which has got some means of learning from some aspect of the design in whatever it is that you're copying. Some famous examples I will consider first. On the screen here, you can see a lotus leaf, and then you can see the bombardier beetle is at the top right. But a lotus leaf, it is hydrophobic. That means water runs off it, as you can see there. And people have had ideas of making glass, self-cleaning glass, such that the water would automatically roll the dirt off it. It has been done, but it's still rather expensive. A gecko foot, it's down there. In the middle, rather, and down on the bottom left is a gecko foot robot inspired by, obviously, the gecko foot, which has amazing hairs right down almost to the molecular scale, which enables it to grip any surface, even upside down. The burdock plant is a classic one which led to the invention of Velcro. The Wright flyer, Orville and Wilbur, who was mainly Wilbur, who looked at the birds and got his inspiration for building in 1903 the first controlled heavier-than-air flight. The Scottish broom sends out seeds at a massive distance. The knobcone pine will only burn and open up, and it doesn't burn the actual cone or the seeds inside. People haven't yet copied the Scottish broom or the knobcone pine. We're beginning to think about maybe means by which we could copy the bombardier beetle. So that's what biomimetics is. And it leads to some implications for design. Many people, of course, will say that in this little bit about design, surely that leads to a God of the Gaps idea. But frankly, I do not buy into that argument. I think it's wrong. When I say that there is an argument for design, because the original thing that we're looking at is the inspiration for man-made design, I don't think that's a bad argument. Because what we're doing is we're learning what we know, and we're not building arguments concerning what we don't know. It's what we do know that I would suggest points to design. So I'm using here an engineering example, but it does have philosophical implications. And I unashamedly mention to you Romans chapter 1, which says in verse 20, the invisible things of him, God, from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Maury looked at the scriptures and saw that it speaks of paths in the sea. He then got his idea of understanding the currents in the world specifically from looking at scripture. Here's a scripture in Romans 1, which says that The invisible things of God are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made. I believe that looking at the way things are made naturally by God in nature actually is a massive pointer to understanding who he is, as Romans 1:20 says. There's more on this idea in the book I've written with Professor Stuart Burgess, Wonders of Creation, Design in a Fallen World. I recommend you going for that book. It's available on Amazon. It's available if you're in the UK from 10 of those. It's available in the US from Masterbooks, and you just type it into Google, you'll find it. It's about £20 or so, or a little bit more in dollars. So there are implications to design. Another verse which I'd recommend that you consider, Colossians 1 verses 16 to 17 says, "For by him were all things created, that are in heaven, that are in earth, visible and invisible, whether they be thrones, dominions, principalities, powers, all things were created by him and for him. And he is before all things, and by him all things consist." If we as Christians do not take the practical implications of Romans 1:20 and Colossians 1:16 and 17 into our science, I believe we are disobeying God not to actually have an all-embracing view of the Godhead in all that we do. That's been my policy as a professor of thermodynamics for over 30, in the discipline of thermodynamics, for over 30 years, and I've been a professor for 20 years, and that's always been at the heart of what I do. I take the view that we should unashamedly acknowledge God in all areas of life. And it says in Hebrews 11 verse 3, things which are seen, and I love this verse, were not made of things which do appear. So God, it says at the beginning of that verse, everything is created by his word. And so his word brought everything into being. And we need to always bear that in mind when it comes to things like information, which I'm not speaking on today. I'm speaking more of a mechanisms, but it's very relevant to the issue of information. There are pitfalls in the design argument. We don't believe in the fixity of species like some people suggest that we do. We accept variation, but we do accept a limitation, many of us. Perhaps this isn't the view of everybody in the ELF forum, I know that, but I personally would say that there is room for variation, but variation has a limit. So we would say possibly the Lord made in the week of creation, he made families. It's probably roughly at the family level that we would suggest that things were made, including bombardier beetles. There is a danger of the assumption of continuity, which is the opposite danger. It's the danger of saying, well, everything has all just sort of come into being from some little bit of life in a cosmic sea of some sort of information billions of years ago. That also is a danger because we actually don't have a continuity. The Bible talks about the fall as a discontinuity. It also talks about the worldwide flood as a massive discontinuity, certainly as regards human beings. And then the other danger is that we should not fall into the trap of saying that the world that now is the same as the world that then was. Actually, 2 Peter 3 specifically says that the world that then was perished. But even going back before the fall, not just before the flood, things changed, and the original world was not made with predator-prey relationships. It was good. Everything was perfect. And if you want more on that point and the discussion of the pitfalls in the design argument, please go and get my other book, which is Genesis for Today, which is also available on Amazon, both in the US and in the UK and in Europe. Coming now to the bombardier beetle, where is it found? Well, I'll talk about that in a moment. I'm just giving you the outline of what I'm going to say. How does it work? We're going to look at the valve system, the chemical system, the chemistry set, as I call it, the twin carburetors, and then a little bit more about what we copied. It's all in the outline that I sent to you. And by the way, the notes that I'm using now, the slides, are also going to be uploaded so that you can take that away with you and examine it at your leisure. I'll talk a bit about the computer modeling. I will also talk about the experimental program, the scaling up, the applications, and we'll go through a little bit on these as time permits. So there is really wonderful engineering in this Beetle. I'm amused actually because although the Bible does not refer to Bombardier Beetles, it does refer in the book of Kings to Solomon examining lots of creatures, including creeping things. So I don't know that he did examine Bombardier Beetles, but certainly the Bible gets close to mentioning these amazing creatures. Where does it exist? Well, it does actually exist in Europe, but it's mainly in Asia and North America, South America, and Africa has quite a big one. As you can see, this is a picture of the African Bombardier Beetle that I did a little bit of work on with in collusion with Tom Eisner from the United States. There are some in Europe, and there's even some in the south of England. They're usually under rocks, close to water, which they need. They're carnivorous. They feed on probably dead things, maybe even they possibly are cannibalistic, but I doubt it. I think they just feed on other dead things that are found there. And then I want to answer the question, how does it work? Well, it ejects a mixture of chemically heated steam and caustic chemicals out of its back end. It's a separate system to its digestive tract. So when it's actually doing this, guys, it's, I don't want to be rude, but the beetle is not making a noise such as when we might make a noise after we've had a heavy meal. It's not doing that. That's just to make you smile. I'm trying to be a little bit euphemistic in what I say. But it wards off predators such as birds, spiders, frogs, and ants, which might be trying to eat this little creature. The beetle doesn't always win, but 99% of the time it wins. It wins by stunning its opponent, by putting out a blast out of its backside, which could be pointed in any direction, as the first picture showed. And it has the capacity to really stun a spider, for instance, a wolf spider, quite a big spider, will come along and sometimes lose a leg over it. It's well known that legs can be actually dislocated by the spider because they think, well, it's not worth me trying to keep that leg, and it scuttles off and it grows another one. So that's definitely happened with bombardier beetles. Frogs have been known to take the beetle and then spit it out again. Birds, similarly. Ants will give way to this blast. And usually the creatures which win are creatures like other spiders which weave a web around it and it carries on blasting and eventually gives up, then it becomes dinner. But other creatures will actually win. It's a rat by actually grabbing it head first and burying it in the sand so the back end squirts away from it. But that is rare. Usually the beetle wins. And the beetle has got a tiny little exhaust turret which will go even over its backside forwards or in any direction it wishes. What does it sound like? Well, this will give you some idea. That's what you actually hear in the laboratory. Let me play that bit again. You actually hear that in the laboratory. This is a video I took with Tom Eisner at Cornell University. This is another video taken by the BBC from their film Alien Empire.
Few creatures will risk annoying a bombardier beetle. It mixes a cocktail of deadly chemicals in a special chamber. They react and explode at boiling point from its rear end in an awesome chemical weapon.
So that's pretty impressive. It's been slowed down a bit. Here's another part of that film. It's another film, this one, Secret Weapons, where Tom Eisner is doing the initial work. And it's this that inspired me, because there is combustion going on, chemistry, thermodynamics, which is my subject. And I got the inspiration from this to see that there is burning going on in nature. I showed you earlier that one example of biomimetics is in the plant world, where fire is necessary to cause the knobcone pine to open its cones. So that there are other examples, but this is the classic one in the animal kingdom.
One of the really amazing things about this animal is its ability to spray in a very beautifully aimed fashion. And that shows up very nicely when you put the animal on indicator paper. And what I'm going to do now is I'm going to pinch very lightly one leg after the other, just as if I were an ant biting these legs. I'm going to start with the right hind leg, right front leg, left front leg,
at 400 frames per second, the action has been slowed down, but not enough to see the individual pulses. So they went to a lab and filmed the beetle at an even faster speed, at an incredible 4,000 frames a second. There were the pulses, each one corresponding to the individual bursts of sound.
I won't be talking about this today, but please notice on the last video that I just showed you, you could see that there was a sensory mechanism going on here. The beetle is not looking at where the attack of the tweezers is coming from, but it is able to sense where the attack is coming from, which is really an amazing example of yet another area which needs to be looked at. So how does it work? Well, I'm looking, first of all, at the valve system. I'm not looking at the sensory mechanism. If you notice, I haven't put that in the notes. But the valve system, as you can see in this electron micrograph here, you can see that there is an inlet valve. It's difficult to speak to this picture without being present with you. But hopefully you can see that over on the left there, where the yellow arrow is going, that you're actually seeing what looks like a bulging case of some kind. Well, it's actually skin which is enclosing the combustion chamber, which we're going to look at in a moment. What I'm pointing to is actually the inlet tubes which are coming in there, and they are pinched by that chamber, which I'm going to talk more about in a moment. And then what was amazing was that when I discussed with Professor Eisner in Cornell, sadly Tom Eisner has now passed away, but he was a brilliant biologist of the old school, just simply investigating. He would hold to a very different worldview to myself, but I had a tremendous respect for the way that he did careful analysis and dissections of these beetles. And this orange arrow is pointing to another bit of keratin, or bit of cuticle, I should say, it's not keratin, it's cuticle, which is flexible. And it's actually, I didn't realize what Tom Eisner had done. At first I thought that he cut through the exhaust tube, and he said, no, I haven't. Let me just put that back up again. He said, no, what I've done is I've just simply pulled away the backside of this dead beetle so that you could see that there is a flap which is normally sitting down, but under pressure, we both agreed, was going to move up. So it's a membrane sitting on the hard cuticle of the exhaust valve. That was a real revelation to both of us. Professor Eisner had not realized that, and I certainly hadn't until we'd had that conversation. So we realized that this was an exhaust valve which only worked under pressure. So there is a four-stage system here. We've only got three in the diagram, but basically you've got where the valve is not opening at all. Then the valve opens, so that's number two. It says stage one on the top right. Then you're coming to the next stage where there is an explosion in the combustion chamber, which I showed, and that stops more hydroquinone and hydrogen peroxide, which are the two chemicals coming in. It's not just those, there is water as well. It's about 25% by volume, somewhere in that region, of those chemicals. We call those in chemical terms reactants. They're the things which are going to react. They then come in to the chamber, as is shown at the top right. Then there is the explosion bottom left, which then the explosion itself stops more reactants coming in. Once the explosion has taken place, then there has to be an exhaust, which is shown at the bottom there of the bottom left picture. And then the bottom right, you see that the pressure is now reduced, and so it's in a car, it would be a butterfly valve, but it's a bit like a butterfly valve here. It now opens under low pressure, and more stuff comes in. It's about 1 millimeter long. It's tiny from our terms, of course, in terms of going down to molecular scales, that's huge. But 1 millimeter is about the typical length of the bombardier beetle chamber. So the fuel inlet valve is schematically shown there, and the exhaust valve is what only became apparent when we looked at the electron micrographs. So this is a sophisticated pressure relief valve at the outlet. During the Second World War, Hitler used the V1 to attack the south of England. And these V1s were powered by a gasoline, the Americans would call it, or petrol engine, which was operating under the same principle. There was an explosion, then the valves were closed as the explosion force went out at the back, as you can see on the top right of the picture. Then, as the pressure dropped, more gasoline would come in, would feel the heat of the previous explosion, react with the air, and there would be another explosion, which is why it sounds like a glorified motorbike. Many people, of course, died, but the only way actually to stop these was to try and shoot them down over the North Sea, which some Spitfires managed to do. But the Doodlebug actually was operating by the same principle. We now come on to the valve system as to what's really, let me just play that again, happening for the beetle. Let me just say that there is an explosion happening, but not just one, a repeated explosion. Just like the V1. And when this was first found out, this was understood after the Second World War. Some of the chemistry was understood by Schildknecht before the Second World War. But it's interesting to see that those who were designing the V1 were actually not realizing it, but they were using a similar principle to something found in nature. Now, we consider the chemistry, and I want you to pay attention carefully to this. Because I put here, we need catalysis 101 here. And in chemical systems, a catalyst is something which doesn't take part in the reaction, but is very necessary to make the reaction work. And it's important to realize that in the combustion chamber, which takes hydroquinone, which is there on the left, and hydrogen peroxide, which is H2O2, an extra oxygen, and it produces benzoquinone, which is the first chemical on the right. There'll be a test afterwards, and Alex Fink and Peter Imming will probably mark it. Peter Imming, probably. No, I'm just joking. But there's just... you don't have to remember all the details of this, but I do want you to see that that chemical reaction does not go of its own accord very easily. Hydrogen peroxide will release its oxygen, but it takes quite a lot of work for a weak mixture to really get going. A strong mixture will do it easily. You usually need a catalyst, though, for other reasons, which I'll show you in a moment. The hydroquinone then and the hydrogen peroxide are catalyzed by two enzymes. In biology, we call catalyst enzymes usually, although an enzyme can be used for other purposes, but it's enzymes, catalase and peroxidase. And the catalytic combustion is very carefully timed. Now, you might recognize this gentleman. It's a certain person from Oxford who is probably... regards me as his arch enemy. We've had a few encounters over the years. And this famous person from Oxford did a lecture nearly 30 years ago to children in 1991 in London. This is the Royal Institution Lectures, which was set up by none other than Michael Faraday, that great chemist of the past. Hear what he has to say.
In fact, the hydroquinone does nothing at all. We can put that on one side. The true story is that hydrogen peroxide on its own does decompose to form oxygen and water, but it needs a catalyst under normal conditions to do that. This black powder here is a catalyst. It's not the catalyst that the bombardier beetle uses. The bombardier beetle does use a catalyst, and it does in fact squirt this hot substance into the face of its enemy. But if you put a catalyst into a weak solution of hydrogen peroxide, then you're going to get a little bit of bubbling, and it's a little bit warm. That might have some effect on a predator, that might slightly deter a predator, and it would be not particularly dangerous to the beetle. Now we've got a smooth gradient, a bit more concentration of hydrogen peroxide, and that's distinctly warm. That would work more effectively against a predator. And by moving gradually up the slope, gradually increasing the concentration of hydrogen peroxide, we can end up with... So there is a smooth slope all the way up to the effective deterrent against a predator.
So what Richard Dawkins is trying to do here is to justify his proposition from his book, Climbing Mount Improbable, that there is no problem, guys. We can actually get over all the issues of what some people would call irreducible complexity, which is that nothing will work unless the whole chemical system and all the valve system and all the other system is there together to make it work. Now, you could guess which position I'm going to come from, but I don't think our friend from Oxford really understood the chemistry. Let me explain. I went to Liberty University and I asked my friend Garth Hewitt to tell me a little bit more about what is happening with these chemicals.
Prophet Street down the center. Yep. That was a flat catalyst.
Platinum catalyst.
Now is your quinone form. See, that's orange?
Yes, that's the orange. Thank you for showing me this, Garth. This is excellent.
Yeah, that orange there would be your benzoquinone. The bottom orangey color.
Yeah.
So I deliberately come back to the Catalysis 101 because Garth Hewitt knows what he's talking about, and many people who are chemists know what they're talking about when it comes to how reactions work. Now, I need to give you a little bit of chemical thermodynamics, because in order to understand what is going on here, I just want to dig a little bit deeper. I've just got a little bit of time, and I hope that I'm carrying my audience. There won't be a test at the end, I assure you, but and you don't need to understand all the details of this. But remember, I put this reaction up earlier, which is hydroquinone and the H2O2, sorry, I've missed out a two there, goes to water. That should say H2O2. I've actually made a mistake there. So it's not with water, it's H2O2, which is the hydrogen peroxide going to benzoquinone and water. Now, that is true. But when you actually look at the details of what's going on, there are important steps. Even this doesn't deal with all the steps. For instance, initially you've got the hydroquinone, which needs to actually give out hydrogen, but it won't release its hydrogen. I'll tell you for why. Because the delta H, which I've put against both these, is plus for the top one, and notice for the red one on the bottom, it's negative. Negative means that it's giving off heat. If it's positive, it means that it's endothermic. It needs heat putting in to make it work. So now I'm coming to a crunch point concerning our friend from Oxford, because it is true that he was stressing this middle reaction, which is hydrogen peroxide, giving off water and oxygen. So the overall reaction I've written down at the bottom, but we're now just going through the stages of the reaction. Even these should really be split up, and in most chemical reaction systems, you can have 100, you could even have 500 reactions, just looking at propane burning in air, for instance. But this is a reasonably simplified system, and even this is complicated. Then you've got hydrogen and oxygen going to water. Now, please notice that this last one is hugely exothermic, minus 286 joules per mole. Now, when you add these up, you actually get the figure which is in red at the bottom. What's the implication of this? Well, we've got benzoquinone there, right, which is on the bottom. And please notice that we've got benzoquinone at the top reaction. The reaction that Richard Dawkins was stressing was the middle one. And he said, we don't need to worry about the benzoquinone. He was actually wrong. You do need to worry about the benzoquinone, or the hydroquinone, I should say, because the hydroquinone is absolutely essential to break it to produce benzoquinone. And the important thing is hydrogen. That hydrogen is then, as you can see on the highlighted reaction, combined with oxygen to produce water. He just thought that it was sufficient to hydrogen peroxide breaking up into water. That isn't, and oxygen. That is not sufficient. What gives you the really hot stuff, as Garth Hewitt showed, was the hydroquinone finally breaking up, producing hydrogen, which then runs away with the oxygen, producing a very, very strong reaction. Well, I need to move on. The chemistry set that I wanted to just mention is the amazing narrow diameter tubes in which Tom Eisner, before he died, believed that the chemicals, hydroquinone and hydrogen peroxide, are actually made in this hugely long, relatively speaking, tubes which feed into the combustion chamber. So these are very, very important to actually understand more. A lot of work has not yet been done on those to fully understand how those tubes work. I've been on at people trying to get them to help, because I can't do all this on my own, but I'd love to find out what's going on in those tubes, because to understand the production of hydrogen peroxide could revolutionize the industry for producing hydrogen peroxide as a cleaning agent. It's also used sometimes for the military. And here, this beetle has actually got a unique system for producing it. Nobody fully understands it. Now, the twin carburetors that I just want to mention, I'm obviously playing with words a bit here because it is a little bit like a motorbike. It's not carburetors, but it's rather similar. It's two combustion chambers where these are firing both together. We'll see that in a moment by some other work that Christine Ortiz did at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. But I want you to see that it's rather like a boxing glove. And when the two, if you could see my fingers here, when the two parts of the boxing glove come together, they pinch the inlet tubes. And that is what's going on under pressure. The same pressure which opens the exhaust tube pinches the inlet tube. And this is the twin carburetors that you can see going on in the work by Christine Ortiz at MIT. She used some sophisticated laser tomography to show that both carburetors are going on together, both combustion chambers. So what did we copy? Well, we mimicked only the valve system. We didn't mimic the chemistry. What we did is we took an electrically heated chamber. First of all, we did some computer modeling, and we took an electrically heated experimental model, which I'll come to in a moment. What we did in the computer modeling is we took a chamber the same volume as what we estimated that 1 millimeter long chamber to be. And this is just 1/8 of that volume. You can see at the bottom right of the colored picture, a little tube coming out, which is representing the exhaust. We're not examining the inlet. We've just got water. We've got gas outside, which we're just saying it's cold steam, or at least steam. We're not worried about that initial condition. We just wanted two phases, basically water and a vapor. And we're going to, if I put up the next slide, you're going to see in a moment the CFD analysis. You're going to see at the red tube, the little tube at the bottom, you're going to see that moving off, as though in the picture it looks like it's going to the left, but actually it's moving to the right. Because what's happening is more and more of the chamber, which is slightly under pressure, 1.1 bar we estimate, is going to be released at time t equals zero. And then you're going to see that the water and the steam are moving out. And we're going to find that there is a clock at the top right, which is telling you how many milliseconds have gone by. And we're going to find that virtually the whole chamber has actually emptied in about a third of a millisecond, which would be about something like 300 to 400 cycles, or represent 400 cycles per second. So let's just have a look at what happens when we release the dividing membrane. Cold is blue, red is hot. Cold water in there initially, it's now being heated up to 100 degrees centigrade. Water, it wants to vaporize, it can't vaporize until it's actually this little, it's a bit like a pressure cooker, if you like, until that little membrane is released. We wanted to see whether having it under pressure made a lot of difference. We're going to assume, because it's so small, laminar flow, for those who are geeks here who understand fluid flows, which I could do a lecture on, but I'm not doing it here. This is a general lecture, but laminar flow with zero slip boundary conditions. So watch what happens. You can now see that the boiling is taking place, that it looks like it's going from right to left, but it's actually going from left to right. It's being ejected, and more of the water inside is vaporizing. And this is running CFX, which is a well-known package. And it's representing what happens very well. So by the time we get to about 3 milliseconds, or even by the time we get to 2 milliseconds, which would be 500 cycles per second, you certainly got rid of most of the water, which we couldn't do without having a pressurized chamber. So we knew that we needed to have a pressurized chamber. So we built a chamber which was about 20 times the 1 millimeter combustion chamber of the Beetle. And we had a very sophisticated receptacle on the right to collect and spray. It was basically a bin, And we were overjoyed when we got this result. This was the first experiment that we did, which worked very well. We had a Malvern laser there measuring the droplet sizes. Then, later, we actually got more sophisticated rigs. And these have applications to fuel injectors. And this is another one which is going very, very fast and is much faster than we did for our original prototype. So we knew that we got things about right when we got this scaled up experiment. So the features that we know about the Bombardier Beetle is that it's got catalytic chemistry, which we didn't copy, precisely timed inlet valve and exhaust valve, a controlled vapor explosion, a sensory mechanism, which again we haven't talked about or copied, a movable turret, which again we haven't copied, the production of hydrogen peroxide and hydroquinone I've discussed, but we haven't copied. It does about 400 to 500 explosions per second, and it maintains a burst for about 2 to 3 seconds every time it does it. So it could do this for about 10 times before it finally gives up. It's really quite a nifty little critter. It's an example of pulsing oscillating combustion. It's a classic example of biomimetics. The core technology we've copied is the valve technology. There are applications to fuel injectors, pharmaceutical nebulizers, aerosols and air fresheners, fire suppression and fire extinguishers, and others are actually listed there. The pharmaceutical, I won't be able to talk about in great detail, but I will just mention a bit about fuel injectors and fire suppression. Fuel injectors, you need a very fine spray. And we were able to get droplet sizes from our rather larger, obviously nothing like 1 millimeter chamber. This is about 22 centimeters, about 20 times that. And by varying the temperature, varying the outlet valve size, which we were controlling, it's not passive like in the Beetle. We were actually controlling when that valve opened, and we, of course, could control the opening. We could get all sorts of spray angles, which is very relevant to fuel injectors. But here's another point. This is from David Attenborough from his BBC Life series. I love his photography and filming, and this is brilliant what he says here.
But the master of chemical warfare is the Bombardier Beetle. It can create a chemical reaction within its body so violent that boiling caustic liquid explodes out of its abdomen. By pulsing the jet 500 times a second, it keeps its rear end just cool enough to prevent it being cooked.
Yeah, that's not quite true. It actually has a very special material, which is yet another issue, which we haven't had time to talk about, to stop itself being cooked. The throw ratio then from 1 millimeter is a chamber for the Beetle, is about 20 centimeters. That's 200, that throw ratio, the ratio of those two figures, 20 centimeters to 1 millimeter. Now, if we look at our 2 centimeter chamber, we could throw again about 200 times the chamber length, which is 2 centimeters. This time with a different exhaust valve size, different conditions, which some of this is under patent, so I can't speak in great detail about those values. But we patented this fire extinguisher application, we patented the pharmaceutical application, and we patented the application to fuel injectors. So this is clearly of interest for fire extinguishers, mobile firefighters with a pack of water on their backs. We're no longer thinking of chemicals, although you could perhaps have a soluble chemical inside, could be taking such a device to try and get at fires which are too dangerous to get too close to, particularly forest fires. So the bombardier beetle has a number of applications. Pharmaceutical, fire extinguishers, fuel injectors are probably the main ones that the beetle can inspire today. Fuel injectors have been taking this principle into diesels already using the beetle technology. Pharmaceuticals, we haven't managed it. Fire extinguishers, we're trying. The droplet sizes are listed there on the right that you need to go for. Fire extinguishers, you can have larger droplets. This work was awarded the 2010 Award for Outstanding Contribution to Innovation and Technology, and it was done with the support of Swedish Biomimetics 3000, which was a company which sponsored this work. I just love this quote from von Karman, who is a wonderful fluid dynamicist from over in California. He said, "Scientists study the world as it is. Engineers," who was trying to show that engineering is an important discipline, "create the world that never has been. We need innovation. And today, biomimetics is one way of getting great innovation ideas." Let me just briefly just say a final word about the fire extinguisher application. There have been terrible fires in the last few years. In California, in July, August 2018, terrible fires 2 years ago, killing firefighters, and very difficult to fight them. Australia last winter was very, very bad indeed, as we well know. These pictures are horrifying, and people died, including firefighters again. Well, what we've developed is a firefighting proposal where you use an ejection similar to the beetle, so scaled up again, but shooting a stream of water at a distance. We think that this could be a great technique for protecting firefighters. More information is on that website below, so please do go to it. There are the patents, and there are papers which I could actually send if people want them. So please go to that website, www.bombardierbeetle.org, if you want to know more. I'm going to close my talk now. God bless you all, folks. Lovely to speak with you. Bye for now.